There were two experiences in my life that helped me understand my use of the next period of time, and I'd like to share those with you. The first took place when I was serving a parish in Washington, D.C. The group was called the Community of Christ. It was a small group. We were in an inner city situation in a poverty area, and we had no church building. We had no beauty of space in which we worshiped. It was a kind of dingy basement of a small row house. And in the summer, if you've not been to D.C., no matter what the Chamber of Commerce tells you, it is hot, sticky hot. So in the summer, we would be trying to worship, and the only way we could survive in the basement was to have the door open and the windows open. That meant the worship service drifted out onto the sidewalk of this poverty area, and sometimes the singing, and sometimes my preaching or our praying, and that attracted some curiosity on the part of the people who walked by, and once in a while, one of God's children would wander in as a visitor. All of them were God's children. But if you aren't aware of it yet, some of God's children are weird. And one Sunday morning, there was a character who came in, never took his shades off, and I couldn't see his eyeballs while I preached, which bothered me. And at the end of the service, I went over. It was kind of a natural thing, I thought. I said, "Hi, I'm John. It's nice to have you here this morning." And he said, "The church is a place I visit about once every 6 months to make sure it's still something I want nothing to do with." What would you have said? I remember what I said. I don't know if it was good or not. I said, "See ya in about 6 months." And I walked away. I just didn't feel like being hassled, and we were too small to worry about public relations and keeping all the guests happy. We just never worried about that. And when I have a cup of coffee, I want somebody a little friendlier than that character. I never thought any more about it. He came back the next week. Didn't take his shades off, but he was a little friendlier. He came back the next week, and I said to Mary, "We're doing something right. The gospel's breaking through to that guy. He's going to take his shades off." You know. About the fourth week, the Community of Christ always had a shared word. I wasn't the only one who got to speak at the worship service. Everyone had a chance to give, in essence, a brief sermon if they felt like it, or at least a sharing. And he stood up. And he said, "You may have noticed that I've been here several weeks in a row, and that's very unusual for me. I also want you to know it has nothing to do with the religious part of what goes on here. When the benediction is pronounced and he quits and you have a cup of coffee, it's really a very nice group to visit with." And I realized all those 4 weeks he was just waiting for me to quit. If all the pastors in the Lutheran Church just knew how many out there were waiting for them to quit, I think we might have a different mood in the church. So I know some of you are waiting for me to quit. That character taught me that, and I understand that fully. Second thing that I've learned, and this is one of the reasons I like it when it's youth and young people. Adults, you'll find this out. Adults, the planners of an adult gathering have to very carefully kind of select the moods. You have to have transition steps. From a game into getting serious, there have to be some preludes and quiet down, what have you. Not with young people. Young people can go from the best kind of hilarity and joking and facetiousness into a very serious moment. You don't have any difficulty doing that. And I found that out, and found out if you say to a group of young people, "For 18 minutes, I'm going to be serious," it's okay. And then we take a break and have fun. I kind of like that. What I'm doing is asking for 18 minutes. Because it sounds very heavy. Contemplative vision. It sounds like old stories of mystic saints. Contemplation sounds like sitting with a vacant stare and your eyeballs rolled up. If I would ask you to image a contemplative, you probably would say, I don't know, but if I passed one on a sidewalk, I'd stay away at least 3 feet. There is a heavy holiness to the word contemplation. I'm going to take only two aspects of contemplative vision, because there are many things we could talk about. I'm going to talk about these two things. Jim Carroll, a Paulist priest friend of mine, has a book called Contemplation. I'm going to take one clue from him. That is, a contemplative vision is not seeing a different world, but seeing this one differently. I'm going to say that again, because if you miss that, you miss half of what I'm going to say. Now listen this time. It's not seeing a different world, but it's seeing this one differently. So that word vision, as I'm going to use it today, I do not think of trance, ecstasy, a vision of heaven and angels. I'm talking about a very common thing. The first understanding you would have had if we had talked about vision. I want you to picture an eye test when you have your glasses checked. I want you to think of the slides last night. I want you to think in terms of seeing and not seeing some different world or heavenly world, but seeing this one differently. That's the first thing we're going to do. Flip Wilson has a character, Geraldine, and Geraldine says, what you sees is what you get. That's what I'm talking about. There is a profound truth to that. How you see, how you perceive, is going to determine what you get and how you live and who you are. I'm talking about that aspect of your life that Geraldine says in a flippant way. A friend of mine lives in New York City. I don't know if you've been there or not. I'm kind of disappointed that in the United States today there is more and more an anti-urban feeling, because I love cities. And I can stand in awe and wonder at Holden. I love Holden. I also stand in awe and wonder, if you see the Big Apple, which is what New York City is called by those who love it, in all of its kind of glory at night. I agree it looks better when you get away from it than when you walk those streets. But when you get at a high place in New York and it's all there at night, I think that's a sight that is kind of breathtaking in its own way. And he did too. He loved the city. So he would take guests up. And there are some places in New York, they're not very high, but high enough that you get a glimpse of it. And he expected, every time they got to this point, walked over to a kind of view place, that the guest would go, he kind of expected that, because that's usually what happened. So he took a friend up there, and this tour was included. They got there, they looked over, and there was no, so he looked, and there was just absolute focus on one spot. And he said, well, what do you think? And the friend said, I would like to know who owns that building. And he pointed to a very large skyscraper. And he said, why would you like to know who owns that building? And the answer came back, because I'd like to sell him his light bulbs. The reason was, that was this man's business. He was a light bulb salesman. And he was from a small town. He had never before seen one building that could set him up for life. If he had just one customer, that building, he would never have to worry about selling light bulbs again. The only reason I tell that story is that's all he saw. His vision was so oriented to what he did vocationally, to his being a salesman, that he missed the panorama and he saw one building. You get a job one summer painting houses, and I guarantee you, for at least 2 months after you quit, you will notice houses that need painting, that were just painted. You will travel a neighborhood you knew, and you'll see with different eyes, only because you're now alert to house painting. And you'll look at the places you just found out were difficult to paint, up under the eaves. You'll see whether they really got at those difficult places. All right. What you see is what you get. Two people went on vacation. They went to the same place the same week, and they each sent back postcards. These were the messages. One person said, "Lousy luck. We've saved for a year to come on vacation. We came to this place because it's a beach, and 4 days last week were miserable and rainy. Love, so-and-so." The other postcard said, "Glorious time. 3 days last week were brilliant sunshine, and we had a great time on the beach." Same place, same week, two people, two sets of eyes, two attitudes toward the facing of life. Paul Halverson and I shared some time near Minneapolis last fall. And when people introduced themselves around the room, one of those introducing himself was in a wheelchair. And in fact, he had to kind of hold himself into the wheelchair because of the situation in which he found himself. And when we introduced ourselves and he said what his discovery probe was going to be, which was the reason Paul and I were both there, he said, "I would like to tell you that the name of what we call this is very important, because people sometimes refer to me as handicapped, and I never use that term. At least I never use it loosely. I am disabled. Whether I'm handicapped or not is pretty much up to me. How I view my disability, I either make a handicap out of it or I don't, but I'm not necessarily handicapped just because I'm disabled." And for the whole 2 days, he referred to us as temporarily able-bodied. You live with that a little bit, and maybe you won't take for granted the fact that we will walk out of here and play this afternoon and all those kinds of things. That was a way in which he saw. I think that was included in a contemplative vision. Repeat what you saw last night and heard Fritz say. Fritz has learned to see. Fritz does not take for granted the smallest and the largest, and does not take for granted things along a path here at Holden. And that's a gift. That's part of a contemplative vision. Jim Carroll had another book, Worship and Wonder, and the very first line in that book is, your world will not be wonderful unless you are full of wonder. The first time I read that, I thought that was very trite. It isn't at all. That's a profound truth. That's what I'm trying to say this morning. Your world will not be wonderful, and I don't mean that in a shallow way. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I mean wonderful unless you are full of wonder. And it is a revolutionary stance. Don't kid yourself. The revolution starts by those who see differently. You look back over history, and a good historian will write not only the newspaper headlines, not even the shifts in the institutions of the time, but they will write the real history, and that's when somebody began to see differently. Let me tell you a story about how we experienced that. Mary and I and our kids lived in the middle of the Black Revolution in Washington, D.C. The Schramm kids integrated the schools where they went. The rest of the students were all black. So we were outsiders to it, but we were right in the middle of it. And it made some headlines. It was a controversial thing, civil rights marches, sit-ins, people going to jail. I want to talk about the revolution as a new way of seeing, because I affirmed that 100% and still do. It came in a phrase, black is beautiful. I want to tell you what that did in our neighborhood. Until that phrase became part of the innards of our neighbors and friends, there really wasn't a revolution. Until that phrase caught as a new way of seeing, there was a group of people who thought and had been taught that black is ugly. And our language does it. If you've not gone to any racism institutions or institutes where you understand the kind of racial prejudice that's built into our language, from black ball to, you just think of all the times we use black. Anyway, before that revolution, we had incidences like this. We had an after-school tutoring program, and we looked for books that pictured all kinds of young people, black and oriental and Chicano, but most of the books had blonde-haired, white, See Dick, Jane, Run, or whatever those books were. Most of the pictures included only white children. Finally, we found some with black children. And the first young man into the tutoring program that afternoon was Mushrat. Every youngster in an inner-city situation has a nickname. His real name was Eric, and how they ever got Mushrat at age 3 or whenever that started, I don't know. But he was a cute kid, one of my favorites. He came in and he opened the book and I wondered what would happen, and he looked and he saw a picture on the first page of black children and he slammed the book down. He said, "I don't want that book. Those kids are dumb." Eric was black as could be. And already at age 6, he was programmed that black is dumb and white is smart. That's violence. I don't know what that did to Eric, but if Eric could say black is beautiful, I could say amen. Because that's part of what the revolution is. That's part of what the gospel is. Good news on Newport Place, where we lived, among girls your age before the revolution was, hey, they found a new hair straightener. That's what good news was, some way to take the kinks out of my hair. And the revolution said an afro is okay. Isn't that right? That was a big moment when black teenagers could let their hair be natural. That's what I'm talking about. It's a new way of seeing. And many times the revolution comes from a new way of seeing. We have a new staff member who came yesterday, Henry. And Sue was at Tempe when I talked about this next new way of seeing, and Henry just beamed because he and I were the only two hillbillies there. He was from Hayseed, Virginia, which is southwest Virginia coal country, and we were from Pendleton County, West Virginia. And I said, "Black is beautiful" was not my phrase, but I have one. My favorite bumper sticker is "Hillbillies make better lovers." And I looked over and Henry was beaming. And they tell me he has that on a T-shirt. And if he has it, I hope he wears it at Holden. Hillbillies do make better lovers. What that's saying is this. We've done a thing to mountain people. If you didn't know that, we really have. They think hillbilly means stupid. And they feel inferior. Our neighbors in West Virginia do not feel on a par with the rest of this country. They've been told that they're hillbillies, and that phrase has been a put-down phrase. And if they can say hillbillies make better lovers, that's their way of saying black is beautiful. And some of the best programs in the mountains are people who are letting young people say to themselves, "Our parents were good, resourceful people. The dulcimer makes beautiful music. It's different, but it's beautiful." And that kind of revolution comes with a new way of seeing. The other thing I want to do today is to quote from one I think is one of the contemplatives of our age. He's dead now. He died in 1968, but he's certainly still a current person. His name is Thomas Merton, and he was a Trappist monk from Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky. When he writes about contemplation, the first thing he says that contemplation is to be disillusioned. And I'm hoping that part of your experience this weekend on Lifestyles and part of your experience at Holden is that you begin to question some illusions. One of the things that you're freed from at Holden for 3 days is TV. And one of the best illusion producers in your life is TV. And I'm going to question it while you're up here, and I hope you learn to question it when you get back to where it's part of your life. We didn't have much recreation in Doe Hill, where we lived before we came here in the mountains. We did get one channel on TV, so we got a TV to kind of keep in touch and to have something to do in the evenings. But we were so aware as a family that it's an illusion-producing machine that the best fun we had was to gather as a family to laugh at the commercials. And they are funny if you can view them that way. They really are. They're a riot. And our smallest daughter learned and enjoyed it the most, and I'd hear her answer, because this was one of the ways we would answer as a family, kind of a family devotions. We would say at the end of somebody saying something, "Who do you think you're kidding?" And then we'd all laugh, and she learned that very quickly. Let me give you an illustration of that. Last night, Fritz Norstedt said, "I just cannot imagine how anybody can live in the midst of this world and be bored." And I can't either. But TV anticipated that. TV knew you did not want to be bored, and so the Ford Motor Company came up with an answer, Mustang 2, boredom zero. That's absurd. But listen to it again. You've heard it, haven't you? If you're bored, the answer to boredom is a particular motor car. Now, think that one through for a minute. Our family did. We didn't write this letter. I wish we had. We composed it verbally one night, but we never sent it. Over a period of 6 days, we didn't have a Mustang II, but we had a Ford, a 69 Ford wagon, a lovely gem of a car. And on Monday of that week, Mary came to meet me at Weir's Cave Airport. You can hardly get there. Only Piedmont will even try to land. But she came to meet me, and the Ford broke down 7 miles before the airport. So Mary hitchhiked, tried to get a message to me. I caught a ride. We finally got the Ford started and went home. On Wednesday, Karen, our daughter, came home from school, 22 miles, back into a mountain area that even the natives call seldom seen, so you'll know how isolated our cabin was. It broke down on the top of Jack Mountain. She walked 2 miles down to Dillon's store, got a neighbor with a truck, and okay. On Sunday, I was to preach, and the thing wouldn't start, and I had to go 2 miles to a neighbor, borrow a pickup truck, come running into the church trying to get my robe on, and I was muddy, and okay. So we had a letter composed. Dear Ford Motor Company, we own a Ford product, and this past week, and we were going to list those three incidents in 6 days and then say, it's true, we were not bored. That isn't what they meant by their ad. But if that's what it means, that you're always fixing it, okay, but I think they had another thing in mind. Just be aware that when St. Paul says, and it sounds so religious, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, one of the things he's talking about is be disillusioned. Don't buy all of the illusions that the world throws at you. One of the best ones, Paul Halverson tonight will take on that as an illusion. Bigger is better. We've bought that. The more you have, the happier you'll be. All TV advertisement that's trying to sell you something has the assumption that we've all bought that illusion. When E.F. Schumacher wrote a book, Small is Beautiful, he was trying to do the same thing that phrase, Black is Beautiful, was trying to do, to give a new way of seeing. There are two ways to get enough. One is to continue to accumulate more and more and more. The other is to want less. That's also a way to get enough. And the point is to be full. And the bigger your appetites are, the harder it is to be full. And part of the thing that the contemplative vision brings us is a new way of seeing. I'm going to end with one more thing. I think one of the illusions that is very heavy upon us is what power means. If I'd had more time, I would have had you do a couple things this morning. One would be to free associate on the word power. I've done it before, so I'll tell you the kinds of things that I would have expected, and then you can test me out. Images of bulldozer, money, banks, muscle, football player, down the list, most of them would have been physical strength, force, big, rumbling. All those things have to do with power. Biblically, power has to do with the root meaning of the word to be able. Someone who is capable. Capable comes from the same word, posse, to be able. And those who are able to be creative, to be themselves are powerful. The New Testament does not say to eschew or to put away all power. In fact, it offers power. Festival of Pentecost, we've just celebrated, was the offer of power. The understanding of what that means is dependent largely upon how you see. The scandal of the Christian faith is if you want to image in a Christian way power, you image a cross. And the world has never understood that. The world says, your Lord was weak because he ended up on a cross. And we say our Lord is absolute power because he gave his life on a cross. We both see the same thing, and one group sees it as power in the absolute power of self-giving love. The other sees it as he was a flop at 33. And when you see differently and understand that power, that makes changes in how you live. I had a Quaker friend who went on the sit-ins in the South. And these are the kinds of things that don't make the headlines. But I want to share with you that he understood. He had a contemplative vision on power. He moved in with a black friend to a Georgia drugstore, and he ordered a Coke. And if you remember those days, blacks did not sit at the lunch counter in southern states. And as David told the story later, he felt in his back the unmistakable object called a knife. He could feel it in his back. And he turned and said, I face the angriest man I can possibly imagine. His eyes raged with hate. One of the local people who was against these Scythian people, these foreigners who are going to change our system. David, having turned, the knife now was right here at his heart. And he had a commitment to power as he understood it, as exemplified in the cross. So he looked his adversary in the eyes. He was in a conflict situation. That's not an overstatement. He looked him in the eyes. That's an important part of it. And he spoke softly. That's part of this power. And he said, friend, and he meant that. You'll miss the whole point if you don't know he meant that. If you couldn't mean that, you won't understand this power. He really did mean that. Friend, whether you push that knife in or not is obviously up to you, not me. I want you to know, in either event, I love you. And that guy's hand shook, and the knife dropped, and he ran from the drugstore, whipped. A big, strong man whipped by a power he'll never understand unless he's pursued it further since. Now, don't ever try to fake that one. You may not always win. He may say, good friend. In fact, the history of the world has an awful lot of this kind of power ending up on a cross. He never promised it was the new way of winning, meaning always having the other guy run. But it is power. It's still, even though it's the scandal of our faith, it is power. And I don't think it comes from anything short of a contemplative vision, of a simply, absolutely, radically different way of understanding and seeing. And I hope part of your experience today and this week goes beyond laughing at TV commercials. I hope that's part of it. I hope it is also a new way to understand the most profound aspect of that faith and commitment to which we're called.